Lives on hold today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. The war in Yemen has displaced a lot of people. Many have fled the country, hoping to join relatives here in the U.S., but President Trump's travel ban has kept them out. One man's family ended up stuck in Djibouti for months.
I can't go see them. I cannot take them back to Yemen. I cannot bring them here. What kind of life is this?
Also, the Trump administration is reportedly trying to cut the U.S. foreign aid budget, even though Congress has already approved the money and wants it spent.
They stated flat out in the memo that they would like to take the money back. It's somewhere north of $3 billion and put it into the Treasury.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Family separation is something no one wants to witness or experience. But we haven't been able to escape the issue these past few months after thousands of families were split up by U.S. authorities at the southern border. Throughout this week, we brought you stories about other instances of family separation, from boarding schools that Native American children were forced to attend to a toddler left behind to grow up in the Philippines without her parents. Today, we want to tell you about a community hit hard by another type of family separation. This one has its roots in President Trump's travel ban. Here's The World's Shirin Jafari.
When I recently called up Zaid Nagy, he was mad.
There is real pain here. There is real suffering. I'm in direct contact with people whose life has been destroyed.
Nagy is talking about the Yemeni community here in the States. And as the head of the Yemeni American Merchants Association in New York City, he's constantly hearing how President Trump's travel ban is separating Yemeni American families.
I just received a call this morning from a gentleman who we've been working with for a while. His family is in three different parts of the world. His daughter and his wife is in Djibouti.
Djibouti, the small country in Africa. That's where the closest U.S. embassy is to Yemen.
His older children are with him here in the Bronx, where he works. He owns a cell phone store. And he has a little kid that he can't take care of. He's staying with people in Michigan. That's one story.
I also have a story. He goes on. There's the Yemeni American grocery store owner in New York whose three children got U.S. visas, but their mom didn't.
Now he's stuck taking care of the kids and working and paying for the mom who's not allowed in.
Last June, while the Supreme Court was debating whether President Trump's travel ban is constitutional, the government argued it is, because it considers exceptions, or what's known as a waiver. Serene Shobaya is a civil rights lawyer in Washington, D.C.
The ban says that there is a case-by-case waiver process through which every individual visa applicant will be considered according to three factors.
Like if the ban causes the applicant, quote, undue hardship, if the person doesn't pose a security threat, and if granting a visa is in the interest of the U.S. But here's the thing. These waivers are rare. Hundreds of families from the banned countries have been waiting in limbo for months for waivers. Shabaya says the government hasn't clearly explained how the waiver process works.
It's become very, very clear that there is no waiver process. People are not getting individualized consideration. And they're not even getting the opportunity to submit documents that would demonstrate that they meet the three criteria outlined in the proclamation for a waiver.
Now, Shabaya and other lawyers are suing the government on behalf of these families. Meanwhile, the stories of families struggling to reunite keep piling up. Like that of Mahmoud Salem, a 31-year-old Yemeni-American man whose family was stuck in Djibouti for about a year.
Mahmoud Salem, M-A-M. O-O-N.
His brother Mamoun told me Mahmoud moved to the U.S. in 2004 following his father's footsteps. Their father had moved to Michigan years ago to work at a Ford factory.
You know, and my dad worked in Ford Motor for over 35 years.
Salem got married in Yemen, but came to the U.S. alone to make money, save until his wife and kids could leave Yemen and join him in the U.S. But Salem's brother Mamoun says he struggled financially.
He don't have like a degree or something to work in a good place to make good money, you know.
Salem stuck it out in Michigan for 14 years. He would visit his family as often as he could. Over time, he and his wife had five kids. Finally, 5 years ago, Salem decided it was time to bring his wife and children to the States. He started the visa process, filled out forms, got vaccinations. Meanwhile, a civil war broke out in Yemen. There was chaos, food shortages, and a cholera outbreak. In 2015, the U.S. shut down its embassy.
There's airplanes, there's wars, there's lack of a government, there is lack of police.
Zaid Nagy again with the Yemeni American Merchants Association. He knows Salem's family.
It's like death is awaiting you. And if you evade it in one corner, it's coming to you from the other corner.
Salem's family was in Djibouti, trying to get U.S. visas. But the cost of living there is skyrocketing. And Salem was struggling to support his family from Louisiana, where he worked at a grocery store. This is what he would tell Mamoun, his brother.
I need a lot of money. I can't go see them. I cannot take them back to Yemen. I cannot bring them here. What kind of life is this?
Mamoun says his brother borrowed at least $7,000 from him and his other brothers to pay the bills in Djibouti. And his wife and five children waited. Then, last month, in a video call with his family in Djibouti, Salem found out that his daughter was sick.
His daughter was in the hospital and they have no enough medicine in Djibouti. She had a rash and a lot of red places on her skin.
A couple of hours after that call, Salem took his own life. It's difficult to know what exactly led to his death, but it happened as Salem was trying to cope with the stress of his family's visa situation.
Hello? Yes.
Lisa Fortuna is a psychiatrist who works with refugees in Boston. She says for many of the refugees she sees, their number one goal is to bring their families to the U.S., often away from war or refugee camps. But the travel ban is making that impossible.
And so in the last few weeks, after the ban was upheld, I had a lot of families come in very distressed, very depressed. And I think it adds to a level of hopelessness. And that becomes a very significant risk factor for suicidal behavior, the hopelessness and despair, that there's not going to be any resolution of the separation from your family.
Paul Spiegel, who directs the Center for Humanitarian Health at Johns Hopkins University, says immigrants and refugees have always been prone to depression and anxiety. Some experience trauma at home or on the journey here. Then there's the stress of starting out in a new country and learning a different language.
I think what is different now is the uncertainty, the changing of the rules and the laws, the aggressiveness of ICE. There was more certainty in the past, and I think that will exacerbate mental health issues and can even create some mental health issues.
After Salem's death, an immigration lawyer helped bring attention to his family's case. His wife and children were granted visas, but they didn't arrive in the U.S. in time for Salem's funeral. His brother, Mamoun, is taking care of them for now. I asked him how they're coping. The hardest part, he said, was picking them up at the airport.
His son started looking, around and cannot see his father,
They're still coming to terms with what happened, he says, and restarting life in the U.S. without their dad. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Senators from both sides of the aisle have condemned a leaked memo from the Trump administration proposing a rescission of the foreign aid budget. That's a bureaucratic maneuver that effectively prevents further spending. The move might save $3 billion. But Senator Bob Corker, the Republican chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, told a hearing this week that the cut was a bad idea and might even be illegal. Carol Morello helped break the story for The Washington Post. Carol, what's in the leaked memo and who's it from?
Well, the memo is from the Office of Management and Budget. Normally, you have to understand the fiscal year ends on September 30th. So normally at this time of year, there's a chunk of foreign aid money that hasn't been spent. So in this memo that came earlier this month, OMB told both the State Department and USAID that they wanted an accounting, a balance of all the unspent foreign aid. And they said in this memo that they intend to go to Congress at the end of the month and tell them they want to take the money back.
Now, the amount at stake here is about $3 billion. It sounds like a lot, but it's only about 8% of the foreign aid budget. Why are the senators pushing back so hard?
Well, this is money that they approved. They think this is money that should be spent. They consider it not just a matter of generosity, but as a matter of national security and in the national interest to help other countries that need a hand or need some development assistance. And so they think the administration is trying to thwart the will of Congress.
Was this particular amount of money, this roughly $3 billion, was it earmarked for specific countries and specific projects?
Well, it has been earmarked for specific countries and projects, although it's not clear exactly what at this point, because all this is just something that's under consideration at the moment. All they have done is ask for an accounting of what has not been committed and all the paperwork turned in so that it can be spent. It's not clear at this point what exactly it is.
I mean, you know, just today or just yesterday, it turns out the military parade that President Trump wanted, they're not going to do that because it's going to cost too much money. But he kind of gained some political favor in some quarters by doing that. Is this being seen in a similar way, that it's kind of, you know, red meat for his base? So it may not happen, but he's put it out there as, oh, we're going to cut foreign aid.
Well, I think in the United States, there's a lot of misunderstanding about how much money is spent on foreign aid when they have done polls and asked people what percentage of the budget goes for foreign aid. Many people will say things like 25%. In fact, it's less than 1%. In Congress, where people understand a lot of people understand the realities, there's far more support for it and far more of an understanding that, as Defense Secretary Mattis has said, if you don't have foreign aid, if you don't have a strong foreign policy, he needs more ammunition. And so in Congress, there's a lot of support for it. In not just his base, but in America at large, there's less understanding of that, in part because people think there's a lot more money being spent on foreign aid than there actually is.
Why is it so hard for members of Congress to defend foreign aid to their constituents?
Well, I'm not a congressional reporter, but I do come from a small town in the Midwest. So I think that the further you get away from Washington, the more concerned you are. You have questions, why is this money not being spent on roads in my community? Why is it not being spent on bridges? Why is it not being spent on hospitals for veterans? There are a lot of pressing needs in the United States, and people wonder why we're sending so much money abroad when there are so many needs here at home.
What happens next?
The next step will be that sometime before the end of the month, the president will have to decide whether to take the recommendation by the Office of Management and Budget and actually notify Congress that it wants to, it's called a rescission package, they want to take the money back. And then after that, it's a question of whether Congress will decide how quickly it can act. Some senators yesterday were already talking about holding up confirmation hearings for nominees. One that they are supposed to consider is for the Supreme Court. So this could very quickly develop and become highly politicized, particularly as we are in the months leading up to a midterm.
That was Carol Morello of The Washington Post. The U.S. and Mexico work together to go after drug cartels. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Relations between Washington and Mexico City aren't exactly warm these days, so it's a bit of a surprise to learn that there's one area where U.S. and Mexican officials are actually working more closely together. That area is counter-narcotics, and it comes after a year of record violence in Mexico. That's what's led to this latest joint U.S.-Mexican effort to dismantle the powerful financial infrastructure of drug kingpins from both sides of the border. Emily Green reports from Mexico City.
The announcement was made in Chicago, where officials from the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency say the city has experienced a record number of drug overdoses and violence from heroin and illicit fentanyl manufactured in Mexico. Brian McKnight is a DEA agent in Chicago.
And to be crystal clear, the drugs are being manufactured in Mexico, and the Mexican cartels control the routes into the United States for distribution. And it's not just Chicago. The same Mexican drug networks also pipe methamphetamine to Milwaukee, Indianapolis, Detroit, and also St. Louis.
But for Mexico, where the drug cartels are based, violence is endemic. More than 31,000 people were murdered last year, the highest number on record. Mexican prosecutor Felipe Munoz-Vazquez, who was also in Chicago, says now it's time for the U.S. and Mexico to work even more closely to eradicate these criminal operations.
Hoy México y Estados Unidos demuestran que cada una de sus naciones.
Munoz says Mexico and the United States are demonstrating to each of their countries the desire to work together. The message that they are sending to the drug dealers is that there are no frontiers to this war. Under the new initiative, the DEA will open an office in Chicago that will focus on international investigations of the drug bosses. The DEA will also create a new task force in collaboration with the FBI, Chicago Police Department, and the Department of Homeland Security that will target local U.S. gangs. And DEA agent McKnight says a big change is that now the two countries will attack the huge financial operations of these powerful drug cartels.
Be aggressively attacking the cartel's financial infrastructure by denying revenue going back down across the border. Hundreds of millions of dollars that goes across the border in drug money everywhere that elevates the cartel's power in Mexico.
This kind of talk may seem obvious. Get the drug traffickers' money. According to the Department of Homeland Security, Mexican cartels earn between $19 and $29 billion from drug sales in the United States. But going after the finances of these groups has not been a priority until now, says David Shirk, a Mexican security analyst and professor at the University of San Diego.
There has been much more of an emphasis on chasing after bad guys and a lot less emphasis on chasing after the money that they're generating through illicit activities.
A report last year from the International Monetary Fund criticized Mexico for failing to investigate and prosecute the cartel's vast money laundering enterprise. According to the report, the drug leaders use the money to accumulate property, weapons, jewelry, and other goods. They also store the cash in safe houses and invest in restaurants, hotels, nightclubs. Shirk says going after these assets is essential to dismantling the cartels.
But it's also a lot easier said than done that we're going to go after the money. These financial schemes are often highly sophisticated, difficult to detect until well after the fact.
Consider this. The Sinaloa cartel is estimated to have made more than $1 billion under the leadership of Joaquin Guzman, known as El Chapo. But a year and a half after Guzman was jailed and extradited to the U.S., neither country has been able to locate the money. This new joint effort between the U.S. and Mexico also doubles down on the controversial kingpin strategy, the idea that you break up cartels by targeting their leaders. Mexico says as part of this deal, it will offer a $1.6 million reward for information leading to the capture of the leader of the powerful Jalisco New Generation cartel. The U.S. has offered $5 million. Jaime Lopez is a security consultant in Mexico. He says for years, Mexico has been focusing on bringing down the top drug cartel bosses at the urging of the U.S., which in the last decade has poured nearly $3 billion into that strategy.
Well, it's a tried and true approach. It lies at the heart of the American criminal justice system as well. There is this notion that big criminals cannot be allowed to roam free on the streets.
But there are critics of the kingpin strategy who say it not only keeps the drug trade alive, it fuels more violence. Deborah Bonello is a senior investigator with the think tank Insight Crime.
The problem with the kingpin strategy and taking out the leaders of the cartels is that they sort of beheaded them, but they didn't dismantle them. And just beheading those organizations creates those power vacuums.
Those power vacuums, she says, lead to turf battles that have turned resort towns like Los Cabos into the scenes of shootouts. This year's political campaigns were also bloody, with more than 130 candidates killed in the run-up to July's elections. And then there are the other big challenges to fighting the cartels: stopping the flow of guns illegally trafficked from the U.S., and tackling drug use in America. Ultimately, whether or not this new U.S.-Mexico partnership to fight drug trafficking will move forward will depend in large part on Mexico's newly elected president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He takes office in December. His spokesperson would not comment on the new drug-fighting partnership. But López Obrador's campaign message was a softer one. Instead of attacking the cartels head-on, he said he wants to address the root causes of violence, Bonello says.
Which is poverty, education, unemployment, you know, all the factors that do drive a lot of young men and increasingly women to get involved in drug trafficking.
Mexico's president-elect López Obrador has floated more ideas that could fly in the face of this new U.S.-Mexico initiative. He has said he wants progressive drug policies, like amnesty for nonviolent criminals, proposals that could challenge this latest effort by the U.S. and Mexico to fight cartels. For The World, I'm Emily Green in Mexico City.
Before we go to the break, I want to tell you about a story we'll have for you next week on the show. It's about a set of mysterious rock formations. You can see them as you head north along the Hudson River in Manhattan. These piled stones look like human figures.
I thought they were natural initially, and I was like, how would this happen? Like, does a tide bring it in? Or
they almost remind me of sort of, you know, lost souls, people who have been here but that are now lost.
The figures are called the Sisyphus Stones, and they're not naturally occurring. They're the work of a man who sometimes goes by the name Ulysses. He's been building and maintaining these stone formations for a year now. They stretch more than 100 yards down the river.
It's my garden. I'm coming here every day. This is where I can free my imagination, I can free my spirit, I can free my breath.
The Sisyphus Stones draw runners, bikers, and walkers, and some say they're creating a kind of community.
It's bringing people together and leading to conversations. And that has been an immediate side effect that happened immediately when he started to erect it.
Why Ulysses began this one-man project and why he's letting it go. That's next week on the show. I'm Carol Hills. Hundreds of Google employees sign a letter in protest over the company's plans to launch a censored version of its search engine in China.
They're saying you can't have us programming things and not telling us the ultimate end use, especially if that end use is going to be facilitating Chinese government censorship.
That story coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Hundreds of Google employees have signed a letter in protest over the company's plans to launch a censored version of its search engine in China. The search engine would blacklist certain websites and search terms relating to human rights, democracy, religion, and peaceful protest. Google's China project had been kept top secret until investigative journalist Ryan Gallagher at The Intercept reported it a couple of weeks ago. Ryan spoke to us after he broke the story, and we caught up with him again today. He says a lot has happened since our last interview.
There was a massive backlash coming from the outside. We had all the major human rights groups all condemning the censored search engine plans from Google. From that, there was then a backlash actually inside of the company, because within Google, only a few hundred of the company's employees actually knew about this secretive plan. And there are 88,000 employees of Google around the world. So there was less than like 0.5% of Google employees actually had any idea about this. So when most of the employees found out, it was from the news reports, and they were furious about it, a lot of them.
What have Google top managers said in their defense?
The first response we actually had from the top management at Google was yesterday. They publicly have still not said anything, but yesterday there was like an all-hands meeting of all the employees at Google. And what was extraordinary was that Sergey Brin, the co-founder of Google, he admitted he hadn't even been told of this until he himself read it when we broke the story. And he has historically been against censorship. When Google was previously in China between 2006 and 2010, they pulled out of the country partly because Sergey was so appalled by the censorship that Google was having to be complicit in. And so they're now trying to do another censored version of Google, reversing their position from 8 years ago. And they actually kept that secret from one of the co-founders of the company. That was a stunning development yesterday. And so we're now going to see, we don't know where it's going to go from here. It seems like they're actually still planning to sort of quietly move forward with it, although at the same time, they're trying to sort of play it down and pretend like it's not all that significant, which isn't what the documents I've seen show.
What do the documents you've seen show in terms of how far along this is?
Well, they show that it was extremely far along. This has been in the works since early last year, and it got moving seriously in spring last year. Sundar, the CEO, was in China on several occasions meeting with some of the most senior people in the Communist Party and the Chinese government, partly to discuss the launch of this search. they actually developed the product to the point that it was ready to be launched within a matter of weeks. The only thing they were waiting on was permission from the Chinese government to launch it. And that is what they've been working towards for since 2015, when Sundar took over as CEO. And leading up to that, they've been investing in China. They've been building, for example, they launched an artificial intelligence research center. They've launched two apps in the last year in China, a translate app and a game. They've been doing all of that incrementally to ingratiate themselves with the Chinese government so they can get the permission to launch the search. This has been a massive strategic effort from Google. So the idea that it's just some kind of exploratory thing is completely untrue.
I mean, how is it possible that Google employees don't know what's going on inside their own company? Is there a culture of secrecy at Google?
Well, this is another really fascinating part of this story, I find, because Google has always had this ethos of being transparent and open internally with its employees. Like every week, traditionally, they had these meetings where all the employees are there, and the co-founders, Sergey Brin and Larry Page, would field questions off anyone. So this is why I think there's part of a big uproar going on inside Google, because they feel kind of like betrayed by the company leadership. You know, the letter that we reported earlier this week that many Google employees are signing in protest, one of the key things there is actually about the secrecy. They're saying, we need to know as employees what we're building. Because what's actually emerged is there's some employees, like, for example, programmers or engineers or developers, they each have a very specific task, and it can just be writing code for a certain application. They might not actually know how it's going to ultimately be used. And this is one of the big controversies. They're saying, you can't have us programming or designing things and not telling us the ultimate end use, especially if that end use is going to be facilitating or being complicit in, you know, Chinese government censorship, which is restricting people's access to information about things such as human rights and protest and political opposition and democracy.
That was Ryan Gallagher, a reporter at The Intercept. He broke the news that Google was developing a censored search engine for China. If you grew up in the USSR or you have family who did, this will sound familiar.
It's Chiburashka.
That's Chiburashka. Think the Soviet Union's version of Mickey Mouse. Except Chiburashka isn't a mouse, and though to some he looks kind of like a bear, he's not that either. But he does have big round ears. There's a reason we're talking about this. Edward Uspensky died this week. He was the writer who created Chiburashka and many other well-loved children's stories and cartoons during the Soviet era. My colleagues Lucy Matarossian and Daniel Offman grew up on his work. They're both producers here in the newsroom. And I asked them about the reaction to Uspensky's death.
While I was producing the show the entire time, I just kind of wanted to go to our editor, William, and say, this writer died and he's really important to me. And I knew that Daniel is the only other Russian speaker in the newsroom, and that's why it was really important for me to flag him down and tell him that Uspensky died. And then we both kind of looked at each other and we agreed that we didn't even know who Uspensky was. We didn't know his name, but we knew about his works, especially about Chiburashka.
And then as soon as I heard it was the creator of Chiburashka, my heart sank. It was terrible. It was so sad. But it was kind of an odd situation where I didn't know who he was, and I've spent the last couple of days reading up about him and becoming ever more sad as I read about his work and his repertoire and recount what I grew up on, all these cartoons that both of us grew up on.
Now, Chiburashka seems to be the key character here. Daniel, tell us about him or her. We're not sure which.
So, as you said, Chiburashka is kind of this unknown creature. He kind of looks like a bear, kind of looks like a mouse, kind of looks like a little circular orange thing. And I think that's the point. You're not supposed to know the origin of this character. He's found. He kind of arrives on the scene in the first episode, kind of jumping out of this orange crate. And this fruit vendor just discovers Chiburashka and just tries to find out what this creature is.
Okay. Чебурашка. Фу ты, Чебурашка какой. Что же мне с тобой делать?
And I looked at that first episode, and he takes them back to the zoo thinking that he may have escaped from the local zoo, and they say, no, you know, he doesn't belong here. I mean, Lucy, what is it about Chiburashka that you identified with?
I actually went back to Chiburashka a few times as a teenager. I don't remember what exactly stuck out to me when I was a kid, but as a teenager, I just for whatever reason decided, you know, I just met my grandmother and my mother's side of the family for the first time. They live in Lithuania, and I wanted to get better at Russian, and I was like, oh, Chiburashka, I'll just start rewatching that. And it ended up meaning so much more to me because I started seeing these themes of loneliness and also just seeing these images of the pioneers, which is all of these children in the communist era who grew up going to these camps. And my mom was one of them, and they wear these orange bandanas. And my mom, when I pointed it out to her, I was like, was that you? And she's like, yeah. So it was kind of a way for me to reconnect and be able to understand where my parents and my family come from.
The pioneers you talked about, is that sort of the Soviet youth groups?
Yeah, exactly. I think the show also kind of showed how to be a good communist. And in fact, these pioneers actually started singing the songs from Chiburashka later on and memorizing them. And it was a part of their camp requirements.
Lucy, I understand there's a favorite clip you'd like us to hear.
There's actually two. So the first one, you'll hear Chiburashka entering Krokodil, the crocodile, Gana's home, because Gana had just put out these Craigslist type ads where he's like, I'm lonely and I need friends. And Chiburashka, he sees this ad and he goes to Gana's home and he just sort of walks in and he's like, this is me.
Chiburashka.
Кто вы такой?
The little girl who's with Gana, who had also answered to his ad, she's like, do you happen to be a bear cub? And Chiburashka's like, well, I don't know. And maybe bear is a sort of symbolism of being Russian. And he's saying, I don't really know if I'm Russian. I don't really know who I am. And at the end, Gana's like, I'll sort this out. And he brings out this dictionary and he starts listing all the cha words in Russian. So chimadan is suitcase. And he's like, I can't seem to find you, but that's okay.
And about that, the suitcase, him kind of ending with a suitcase, is kind of a symbol of displacement, of movement, of migration. And that's kind of a big part of this character. As I said earlier, we don't really know what Chiburashka is. And throughout the show, it's about finding out who you are, finding a community, finding friends, and Chiburashka is kind of a symbol of someone who doesn't fit in anywhere. So for a kid, and even for someone looking at it now, you could really identify with this character.
Are you saying that there was sort of a certain Russianness or Soviet overlay to it, to the idea of displacement?
So there are a lot of layers to this funny little character. Many of the people who worked on this cartoon were actually of Jewish origin. Many of them were persecuted by the Soviet regime. Many of them came from different areas in the Soviet Union and ended up in Moscow working on this show. So there are just so many, starting from the oranges, there are just so many symbols, so many little Easter eggs showing that kind of Jewish origin. Famously, a lot of the oranges in the Soviet Union were imported from Israel. And this is kind of a point of pride for many Soviet Jews. And actually, I remember my parents telling me about the oranges, saying that shopkeepers would spend time crossing out the Jaffa oranges symbol. And at times they would write Morocco over it, or they would just make sure that no one knew where the oranges were from. And so Chiburashka literally coming from an orange box, was kind of a symbol, like a little hint to the Jewish nature of many of the writers and creators of the show.
I think that this otherness that Chiburashka represents, it a lot of people do feel like maybe you're not Russian enough, and that's really complicated to explain, but even for me, since my family is ethnically Armenian and part Russian, I say that my mom, she's Russian, she's ethnically Russian, but when people ask me where she was born and I say Tbilisi in Georgia, they're like, oh, she's not Russian, she's Georgian. And to me, that's like, wait, what? But and people will even say that, Russians will even say that to people who were born outside of St. Petersburg or Moscow. You're not really Russian. And even, I think, for you, Daniel, you can identify with that, being Russian and Jewish.
It's hard to define what Russian really means. And for many smaller ethnic groups or many religious groups, it's hard for them to identify as Russians because the Russians, the Moscowites or people from St. Petersburg never really accepted them.
Lucy, you mentioned you had a second clip you wanted us to hear about Chuburashka.
Yeah, I do have another clip, and this one is Gana, the crocodile, making this profound realization about loneliness.
А вы знаете, сколько в нашем городе живет таких одиноких, как Чандр и Тобик? И никто их не жалеет, когда им бывает.
So what's happening here is Gana, the crocodile, Chuburashka's friend, he makes this realization that it's not only them who are lonely. There's other people like Leb Chander, who is the lion, and Chuburashka and the little girl Galya, who's with them. They're like, but we want to help them. What do we do? And Gana says, I've got it. We should just make everybody become friends.
А я уже придумал. Их надо передружить.
And what happens next is that they literally just start building this friendship house. Everybody comes in with bricks and tools, and everybody's helping, and more people come, and they're like, do you need help? And they're like, of course. So I think that's also kind of to show us what communism must have looked like, or what people thought was valuable back then. What were their priorities? And it was, you know, we have this community, and we're going to take care of each other, and we're going to build this house if nobody else is going to build it for us.
Yeah, and it's so interesting how the show could kind of balance that, what you're describing as this kind of idealistic vision of what communism should be or could be and perhaps never was, and how they're also able to identify a character like Chuburashka who never fit into the system. And you kind of have both of those things coming out in this kid's cartoon.
Lucy Matarossian and Daniel Offman are producers here at The World. They've been remembering one of their favorite Soviet writers from their childhood and the characters he created. Thanks, Lucy and Daniel.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
If you've ever been to a quinceañera, you'll know there's a lot of dancing. In case you haven't come across the term, a quinceañera is a party for girls turning 15. It's a Latin American celebration that's growing in popularity here in the U.S. There's food, there's fancy clothes, and most importantly, there's dancing. Usually the dancers are friends and family, but not always. In Dallas, you can hire a quinceañera dancing troupe. They're called the Latin Boys Cadets. David Hernandez is the founder of the Latin Boys Cadets. David, why would people hire dancers they don't know for what is, after all, a family party?
It's just a more professional way to go by getting your own court of honor. That's what it's called whenever you have your guys and girls that you pick up like friends and family. Usually get them together and they help you do it. But when you go with the Latin boys, it's more like professional guys. They know what they're doing. All you have to do is come in, learn the dances. Basically, we go to the event with you and they perform the dances with you. So it's not out there looking for friends and family to want to do it, because most of the time they don't want to do it. Latin boys is kind of like an easier way out. Yeah, they don't know the girl, but they get to become friends as they're practicing all the time, because the girl does have to go through 2.5 months of practice.
How did you get the idea to start the group?
I was, a chambelán myself. You know, chambelán is the, you know, you stand up for the quinceañera. You're one like her escort, guiding her around everywhere, dancing with her. I was one of those in many events. And I was like, man, I've done like 3 of them just this year. Seems like it would be a pretty good idea to just put boys together and just have them ready in case you need us. We're here to help you. Little by little, you know, the demand is asking you more and more for you to keep going.
So, David, you're the boss. You pulled this together. How old are the dancers? They're all boys. And how many are there? Just kind of draw a picture for us.
I have about 35 boys.
In the Latin Boys Cadets?
Yeah, 35 boys. And they all start between the ages of 14 to about 17. After the 17-year-olds, 18s, I try to get them out. We try to keep them a little bit younger for the quinceañeras, which they're only 15. But it's just a youth thing. It's for them to come out, gain some confidence, dance, make some money doing it, but a responsibility.
And it looks like from pictures that the dancers put a lot of thought into their look. They use hairspray, hair gel. Describe what goes on for the boys themselves to prepare.
To a point, they become like an artist. because the boys do, they have their own look. Even now with social media, they're actually like, you know, have so many followers. You know, they do take care of their hairstyle. They do take care of their looks. We do ask for them to do take care of themselves because a customer wants to come buy, you know, will come rent a good quality product. We want handsome looking guys. I mean, you don't have to be extremely handsome, but, you know, we want to give a good product to the customers.
It's interesting to hear you talk about the kind of boys you need for the group because you say they need to look nice and be kind of handsome and be guys that the girls want to hang out with. It's funny, if we were talking about girls, it would sound like you're objectifying them and it wouldn't sound right. So do you ever think about
in terms of picking the guys? I'm not saying that. I mean, I have a lot of guys of different, how can you say that? I have tall, I have short, I have fat, I have skinny. There are all kinds of guys. There's times where the girls come in, they pick a guy, and I'm like, really, you picked that guy? I would have never thought you would have picked that guy. Or you have one that just, oh, I'm set on this one. I want this guy. That's the guy that I want.
You don't pick the guys yourself?
No. My rule for you to join my group, you come to practice and you learn the dances. If you're dedicated enough to come to practice and learn the dances, you're part of my group.
Do they wear a particular uniform or clothing?
We do have several different uniforms that we use. We have one where it's just a tuxedo, or we have what we call the cadet suit, which is the military top. We actually take off all the things that come from the Marines, which is like the gold eagles, the patches on the side, the buttons that we have are a little bit different than what they have. We kind of gutted it out and just left just the jacket with the buttons. We provide the belts on, and then the boys will wear black slacks to go perform. Really, whatever the customer's really looking for, we can actually do it. I mean, it's just some girls want, oh, I want suspenders, or I want this color shirt. We just go from there.
Does the girl celebrating the quinceañera, does she pick one of the guys from the Latin Correct. Boys cadets to hang out with that night and dance with?
Correct. She'll pick one of the boys as her main one. And then from there, she can kind of give us an idea of who she wants, or we'll pick the rest from there. Now, another thing, you know, a lot of people just say, oh, it's just Latin guys. Like, no, it's not. We're not just Hispanic. We've had Anglos in our group. We've had African-Americans in our group. It just depends. We're not just Hispanic.
And what kind of music do you practice to and the dances that you do?
You know, hip hops, you know, a lot of the Latin music. It just really depends on the girl because some of them bring me country most of the time. Some will bring me Latin music, just a variety.
What's the hot style right now?
I would have to say hip hop is in demand. There's a lot of cumbia and bachata. It's all slow. It kind of has nice movement, so it's easy to dance to.
So how does it work? I mean, you get a call and someone wants to hire your group for a quinceañera. What happens next?
My first question is before asking anything is the date and where. Because once I know the date, I'll know if I'm available. And once I know where, I'll be able to see how much their price range will be. It's very rare for me to say that I can't do it. The reason it's rare is because I can do up to maybe 9 or 12 events in one Saturday.
You're kidding.
If that makes any sense.
No. How do you do nine?
Okay, so we would run three groups. Each one would take them about an hour, maybe 45 minutes to an hour. So they would do each show, run to the next show, do that show, run to the next show, and they would be finally finished. So like what I'm saying is that we don't last more than an hour at an event. We are going from one to another to another. So if we have to change for another party, then they'll get to that event, change outside, and then they're running back into that event.
A big part of the Latin Boys Cadets seems to be the dancers themselves develop a degree of financial independence. Do you see yourself as a mentor or role model?
I try to be kind of like, a counselor too. I mean, I talk to the boys a lot about how they should work with their money, how they should save their money. I always talk to them about, you know, having good credit because a lot of these families, they don't sit down and talk to their kids about that. So I kind of sit down, talk to the guys about their school, getting into college. I kind of help them out with as much as I possibly can. But that's what kind of we want from them. We want them to keep going. We don't want them to get stuck where we are. We want cadets to be kind of like an opening.
David Hernandez is the founder of the Latin Boys Cadets in Dallas. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
See pictures of some of the Latin Boys Cadets dancers, check out our Instagram. We're at PRI The World. And we leave you now with Baila Esta Cumbia, an old song by the late Selena that is still a quinceañera classic. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for being with us today, and have a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.